Session number 10642, Reel 2.
You were saying, Mr. Bird, Reel 2, you were saying that the role of your squadron was a reconnaissance bomber role.
That's right, yes.
Can you say more about the reconnaissance role and how it was carried
out? Well, the whole point is, your reconnaissance was to see what activities were going on beyond the lines. Any concentration of guns, concentration of troops, railheads, ammunition dumps. Now, on your reconnaissance that, then your next trip, this was all recorded in your head and then given into the control room. And then the next trip was, they were sorted out which was going to be tackled and what weight of bombs you took. It was only a light concentration of troops. You only used the 20-pounders. If it was a railhead, you drop a couple of 60-pounders. If it was a big ammunition dump, which incidentally would also combine a railhead, you dropped your 120-pounders. I've got a picture of one going off, but it won't take me my squadron. I'll show you those in a minute.
How were the bombs launched?
From your control. You had a bomb release. And you're right, we also carried a camera. But that camera was a box camera, tapered, about 14 inches deep, 12 to 14 inches deep, with the double half plates in. You took a picture, you had to pull it out, reverse it and take the next plate.
So this was to monitor how your bombs were falling?
That's right, yeah.
How accurate was the bombing?
Big pun?
How accurate was the bombing?
Fairly good. I would say 90%. You might have been on a bomb run, and then, all right, you were being attacked. Therefore, you'd be sliding away, and you drop your bomb to get rid of them, and, of course, that was a little bit that you didn't get correct.
Were you ever aware of the Germans trying to deceive you by having decoys?
No.
Because that happened a lot in the Second World
War. I know, yes. Yes, no. Never knew of any decoys.
So you don't think it happened?
No. Because they had a very large balloon barrage, observation balloons, very big ones. Matter of fact, we had one drift over our aerodrome that had broken loose. That was down at Swizens, near Swizens. And matter of fact, one of our pilots went up to shoot it down.
Did he succeed?
Oh, yeah, got it down. Nobody in it, though. Only the binoculars.
When was that?
That was the end of 1917.
From what kind of height would you bomb, then?
Very low. When you compare what it is today, it would be only from about 15, between 15 and 20.
15 and 20 what? 15 and 20 hundred?
Miles.
15 and 20 hundred feet?
Feet. Of course, 20 was the very highest ceiling in our days. That was the very highest ceiling. And when you think what they do now. As a matter of fact, I lent it to my nephew. It's a book, I think he was an American, and he was the first man to break the sound barrier. Very interesting book. I've got to get it back because it was Sony lent to me.
Oh. Did you ever go up so high that you suffered from lack of oxygen?
No. Never went that height. Never. No.
And what about the speeds that you were capable of?
90 to 100 in a BE.
What if you had a headwind?
That would drop you down a little bit. It's flying in strong winds was a problem. You see, you had so much wing that would take the wind, and according to the way you catch it, so it would tilt you, and it became a problem. And your biggest problem in high wind was landing, because once you landed, you got a high wind. That's when you could turn it up on its nose, when it would catch your tail plane and lift it up.
Did you ever have any near accidents?
Only one that laid one on its back.
How did that come about?
Not using the elevators right.
Where did it happen?
In Bristol, on the British and Colonial Aerodrome, Filton.
Was that during training?
No. No. Just one of those things, you know, just as they say now, error of judgment. Didn't do any harm or any damage, broke the prop, that's all. That was all that was done. You're just left there hanging with laying on your safety belt, which got a big pin through on a leather thong. You've got to try and pull it out with the weight of your body on it.
Was there any danger of fire?
Very so. Never saw a fire on any plane. Never. Never.
Because the Second World War pilots suffered a great deal from
it. Ah, yes. Well, we had a pilot. I don't know what flight he came out of, but over Doulon's, his propeller sheared off. And he only had about 4 miles to glide, and he glided to the aerodrome, made a perfect landing with no propeller. The only point is he got no control with no power, and of course as he swung around to stop, he hit the hedge right at the bottom end of the aerodrome. No damage.
How long could you stay up for?
What?
In flight?
Well, the whole point is, your maximum in those days would be... only up to about 6 or 8 hours. That was the only amount of fuel you carried. So you had one small reserve tank. Incidentally, that was on the top of the plane. The only held, I suppose, about 4 gallons, I suppose. But there never seemed to be any reason why a plane should catch on fire in those days. In fact, you never gave it a thought it was going to catch on fire. And the fact is, I've never seen one on fire.
What did you think of the aircraft which the Germans had?
That's some good craft. That was one of their best.
Which one?
The Fokker. You know who designed it, didn't you?
No.
He was a Dutchman. And he offered it to us. We turned our nose up, said we can design our own. As he said, he was only interested in business, so he sold it to the Germans.
Were you ever in dogfights with the Germans?
Yes, but not very, very bad ones. Because as a flight, you was there, one was watching the other, and the other was watching the other. And if you got into a bit of a tight squeeze, the other was there straight away. But, never come back with any damage. Never any damage at all. Yet you'd see another one come back, and he got bullet holes through his wings, through his fuselage.
Can you describe any of the dogfights that you were in?
Well, they're hard things. You see, it's all done at the moment. You're up, you're down, you're up, you're down, you're round. The greatest man for a dogfight, now I've told you about Bransby Williams. Now, Bransby Williams was known as Sideslip Willie because he was a great exponent to get out of a combat by tipping his plane up and sliding down on his wing tip. That's why they called him Sideslip Willie. Great pilot.
So you never shot a German plane down?
Not knowingly. This is the whole thing is, no man can claim a victim unless you can get the confirmation of another pilot. No man. You can come back and say, I think I got him. And it has to be left at that. You get a lot of them come back saying, oh, yes, yes, there. Who saw it? Who was near you? Do you know? Because they've all got your numbers on and that, on your side of your plane. Oh, it all happened so quickly and that, but it's no good. They don't get the credit. They don't get it.
If a person was credited with a kill, would they put up a German cross on the plane?
On the plane, yes. Put one on the side of the plane. I forget who it was now. I've got the most. I know Captain Ball had quite a few. McCudden had quite a few. I forget some of the names now. After all, it's a long time ago.
Did you see much of the French Air Force?
No. No.
Did you see them at all?
No. No, never saw the French Air Force at all. When we were at Bayeux, we had the 3rd Anzac Squadron on our aerodrome. And on the aerodrome was in two halves. One half was on one side of the road and the other half on the other side. But there was only one squadron there. And that was number 2 Royal Naval Air Service Squadron. You know when the Air Force was formed?
1918.
When? What date?
1st of April.
That's right. You're dead right.
So, the Anzacs were Australians and New Zealanders, were they?
No, Australians.
What opinion did you have of them?
Good pilots. And their plane, they had the REH, commonly known as the Harry Tate.
Why Harry Tate?
REH. Cockney slang.
Rhyming slang.
That's right.
The Australian soldiers often had a rather wild reputation.
Oh, they got a very wild reputation. I remember, as a matter of fact, so many of us come back on rest, and there was an Australian brigade and a brigade of the guards together, and there was fights galore between the two of them. Of course, you know our guards are the top boys. And they never put them anywhere near. They were shifted out next day after a big do that night.
Where and when was that?
Beginning of 1918, that was.
Whereabouts?
Oh,
were the Australian pilots of the same excitable disposition?
No. They seemed to come from a different breed, if you can put it that way. Oh, no.
Now, you mentioned the Royal Naval Air Service.
Yes.
What was the relationship between the Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service?
That's all right. You were in the same lot, really, except one half you was on the sailor side and the other half was on the soldier side. And, oh, no, there was no question of being different or anything like that. We were actually the senior service of the two because we were a greater service. We had so many more squadrons than them. And yet it was a Royal Naval Air Service lieutenant that brought the other Zeppelin down.
So there was no rivalry with
them? No. You know who brought the second Zeppelin down, do you?
No.
Lieutenant Warnford. He brought it down at the mouth of the Thames. That was the only two brought down here.
Which service do you think was preferable to serve in, the Royal Flying Corps or the Royal Naval Air Service?
Well, I'm a Flying Corps man. Put it like that.
So you're naturally biased. So you never had any desire to serve with the Navy?
No, none at all. Although, when I was closing that balloon depot down there, that was a naval one. The actual depot was naval.
Coming back to your work on the reconnaissance and bombing, how much effect do you think the bombing had?
Oh, I think it achieved what it was meant to do, to let you show that we had got some strength, which we had, because we held it for a time, you know, supremacy of the air, which gradually faded out as their planes greatly improved. Two other planes they had, which were both very good, the Taube and the Albatross. They were too good. So those three, that was their three main planes.
When did we hold supremacy of the air?
On the last lap, when we beat them.
But before that, it was German supremacy, was it?
Prior to that it was, yes. Then we got the supremacy. That's when we were getting the better class of aircraft, such as the SE-5s and the Sopwith, the Camels, and those type of planes. And, of course, they were such good maneuverable planes and good gunpowder.
Which was your favourite of all the aircraft?
I'm still a lover of the B-2C.
For what reason?
I don't know. It was such an easy, controllable plane. Mind you, I like the Camel, you know, but I did like the B-2C. I did like it. It was, mind you, back in those days, 19, 16, 17 and that, we were only in our infancy of aircraft, weren't we? And of course, you know when the ROC was formed? 1911, but unofficially, but officially 1912. Prior to that, the ballooning was done, that was the round balloons, what they called the free balloons, that was done by the Royal Engineers. And they also had, for observation, man-carrying kites. Would you fancy going up on a kite?
No, thank you.
Nor me.
We haven't said anything so far about the service that you got from the ground crew. Can you describe that in the First World War?
What, the ground crew?
Yes.
Well, I'll put it in ordinary terms. They were a gang that was all friendly together. They were just a gang. They got on with their job. You had the engine, the riggers and the fitters. And they worked together. That was the two. There was nobody else at all.
Did you have a special armament special?
Oh yes, you had your armourers. They were the one. The armourers were the one who attended to the guns. The armourers were the ones who put on the bombs. And they cleaned all the guns, took them down, cleaned them, and put them up. Now, originally, the Vickers Maxim air-cooled had a webbing belt, which had to be... That was always loaded by the armourers. Individual. And then they suddenly come to... That was in the latter part, or the beginning of 1917, they came to disintegrating links. Now, these were only small aluminium links, and each cartridge joined the next one up, and you built your belt up cartridge by cartridge. Now, when that was used, you had a box, and as your gun was used, so these links dropped into this box, and they were not damaged and could be used again. Now, with the old canvas ones, that's why you got so many jams, because they twist and jam your gun. And it's a hard job to unjam a gun. Very hard job. You might be lucky with a couple of sharp tugs, but they're very hard to. Very hard.
Did the Grand Crew ever get taken up in the planes?
Not overseas. Over here, yes. But not overseas. No. You could get some to put in an application to become an air an observer. They could do that if they wanted to. And if they did, they immediately came back to England. Made England here. And you'd get a replacement for the squadron. He wouldn't come back.
Would you say that you were very lucky in France, personally, because we get the impression...
I'm very, very lucky. Very, very lucky. Yeah. Yes, I am. I am. I'm lucky. Yeah.
Because towards the end of the war, people in the Royal Flying Corps air crew weren't lasting very long, were they?
No. No. In fact... In 1916, they reckoned a pilot, an observer's life, was anything 3 weeks or a month. It was only... That's what they put it down to in that short period. Not that it happened, though, to that extent, but that's what they reckoned. 3 weeks or a month.
Why didn't it happen to that extent?
Well, the whole point is this... It could happen in that time, but not always be killed. You was forced down, and you made it forced down over their lines, same as Theodore Herm was, same as Leif Robinson was. They were both forced down over their lines, but neither of them were killed.
What about your relations with the French civilians? Did you see much of them?
Yes. I've only got one. I would tell you one thing. Personally, I've got no time for the French.
Why is that?
Well, I for a particular experience, we were changing aerodromes, and all the planes are gone. We came back, and then all that was taken there was the riggers and the engineers, and came back to fetch the rest of the squadron back in their in the lorries, Leyland lorries. And it was a sweltering hot summer's day, sweltering. They'd used their water bottles, pulled up at the farm, and went in to get some water. Took all the troops in there. And they charged them 5 centimes for a glass of water out of the well. That's the French. Now, 5 centimes, all right, it's not a lot of money today, but in those days it was 27.30 francs to the pound. So there was only 20 centimes to a franc.
Where was this?
Oh, between Popperinge and Bayeux.
When would it have been, approximately?
The end of August, 19... No. That would be in the middle of 1917. Middle of 1917.
But was that typical, that they tried to make money out of you?
Well, it just told you what they were like. And yet, individual families, they could be, you could get them very likeable. Now, when we were at Bayeux, I went down, he was a corporal who I knew, incidentally. Come how I knew him first. When I joined 19 Squadron, it was at Castle Bromwich. Now, 19 was formed in September 1915. I joined them in December 1915. We're walking across to the hangars. This corporal come across, and I looked at him. I said to Corporal, I said, I know you. He said, I've seen you as well as somewhere. I said, where did you live? He said, West Norwood. I said, so did I. I said, which school did you go to?